Mediumship and Folk Models of Mind and Matter. In this short paper, I intend to explore the role of experience with trance and physical mediumship in the development of folk models of mind and matter at a non-denominational spiritualist home circle called the Bristol Spirit Lodge. Mediums and sitters often claim that mediumship has led them to understand the world differently, and to appreciate that the standard materialistic view of science is inadequate as an all-encompassing model of reality. Certain key themes and concepts have emerged from my informant's experiences with mediumship that hint at alternative models of understanding mind and matter, including the idea that bodies are permeable, that matter is immaterial, that consciousness is far more expansive than our normal waking state would lead us to believe, and that persons are multiple, can survive death, and may be augmented by external spiritual entities. These themes will be explored through ethnographic interviews with mediums and sitters at the Bristol Spirit Lodge. The varieties of spiritualist mediumship. To begin then, it will be necessary to give a brief introduction to the history of spiritualism, and in particular to physical mediumship, in order to give an idea of the kind of spirit mediumship I've been investigating. Specifically, I'm talking about Euro-American spiritualism, a movement that began in the mid-19th century, but that clearly possesses many historical precursors, as well as parallels in other cultures. Ethnographic parallels include the many varieties of what is loosely termed shamanism, perhaps best defined in Mircea Eliade's terms as referring to a set of techniques for making contact with the spirit world, rather than referring to a single cultural expression. Other parallels include, for instance, the wide variety of what are again loosely labelled spirit possession traditions, and what Joanne Lewis refers to as ecstatic religions. Of course, there are important differences between these various traditions, but all share the common theme of utilising altered states of consciousness of one form or another as a means to interact with the spirit world and the divine. So the Euro-American spiritualist movement was and is, therefore, part of a much wider human phenomenon. The spiritualist movement also had historical predecessors in the form of, amongst other seers and prophets, the 18th century Swedish mystic and scientist Emanuel Swedenborg, whose journeys through the spirit world while in trance seemed to preempt the spiritualist movement by almost a century. The craze for animal magnetism, also known as mesmerism in the early 19th century, also preempted and was eventually subsumed by the spiritualist movement. Patients undergoing mesmeric treatments often seem to exhibit extrasensory powers while in the mesmeric trance, and some even claim to be in contact with spiritual beings. But the spiritualist movement as a distinct phenomenon didn't officially take shape until March 31, 1848, when in the small town of Hydesville in New York State, the home of the Fox family became the locus of some unusual psychokinetic activity. The Foxes were plagued by perplexing anomalous bangs and knocks on the walls and ceiling of their modest wooden house. In an effort to make sense of what was going on, the two youngest sisters of the family, Kate and Margaret, began to address the knocks as though they were being produced by an invisible intelligence. The sisters soon realised that they could communicate with its apparent invisible agent through a simple code of knocks, one for yes and two for no, and in this way discovered that the mysterious knocker was the spirit of a peddler by the name of Charles Rosmer, who had been murdered in the house some years before the Fox family moved in. This became known as the spiritual telegraph. News of the Fox sisters and their apparent ability to communicate with invisible spirits spread rapidly across the United States and Europe, leaving a trail of individuals discovering their own ability to communicate with the dead. By 1853, only 5 years after the movement's birth in New York State, spiritualism had become a religion and spread across the Atlantic to secure a firm foothold in Britain with the establishment of the first spiritualist church in the small town of Keighley in Yorkshire. Before long, the manifestations of spirit communication began to diversify, evolving from simple question and answer sessions with knocks, through experiments with Ouija boards and automatic writing, to full trance communications utilising deep altered states of consciousness, and eventually to the alleged materialisation of spirits from the mysterious semi-physical substance known as ectoplasm. So the earliest form of spiritualist mediumship, comprising physical raps and knocks, evolved into what was later called physical mediumship. And perhaps the most influential innovator in early physical mediumship was the Scottish-born American medium Daniel Douglas Hume. After an early life allegedly filled with spiritual visions and premonitions, Hume conducted his first séance at the age of 18 and swiftly gained a reputation as a powerful medium. By 1856, Hume was conducting séances in Britain. In 1868, he performed his most famous paranormal feat, the levitation of his body horizontally out through a third-story window at Ashley House in London. In 1874, Hume's mediumship received further support with the publication of physicist Sir William Crookes's positive report. Using specially designed laboratory equipment, Crookes tested Hume's ability to change the weight of physical objects and to play tunes on an accordion suspended out of reach and in a cage. But owing to numerous exposures of fraudulence, especially after the foundation of the Society for Psychical Research in 1882, physical mediumship slowly declined in popularity to be replaced by the somewhat more refined forms of clairvoyant and trance mediumship, which came to be known as mental mediumship. And few of the most influential and rigorously investigated mental mediums, Leonora Piper, Gladys Osborne Leonard, and Eileen J. Garrett, would enter into a trance state during which ostensible spirits would communicate through their bodies. And this is what's called trance mediumship. Today, Euro-American society is perhaps most familiar with platform mediumship. This is the kind of mediumship that you'll find in the spiritualist churches, as well as on television programs and theatre stages, and is often referred to as clairvoyant mediumship. Platform mediums do not necessarily enter into a trance state, at least not a particularly deep one, and the spirit communications they receive are often highly symbolic, usually requiring interpretation. So by the late 1950s, physical mediumship was virtually extinct in the United Kingdom, though there were several exceptions, including the physical mediumship of Helen Duncan, Minnie Harrison and Jack Webber, amongst a few others. But it wasn't until the 1990s that interest in physical mediumship returned to the popular consciousness. A reinvigorated interest in physical mediumship developed after the publication of Montague Keane and David Fontana's The Skull Report by the Society for Psychical Research in 1999, and the popularised version The Skull Experiment, also published in the same year. Montague Keane, one of the parapsychologists who investigated the group, describes the basic claims made about the Skull Experiment. He writes, "Based on 2 years of regular seances, the group's chief claims were that they had established contact with a team of spirit communicators. These had been accessed through a husband and wife team, both of whom entered swiftly into deep trance, remaining thus throughout the proceedings, of which they retained no conscious recollection. The purported discarnate contacts had facilitated the manifestation of spirit lights, moved furniture, created apports, or objects appearing from no known source and by no known means, displayed shadowy figures described as angelic forms, and produced films allegedly employing a novel form of energy not involving traditional ectoplasmic extrusions." So regardless of whether or not the phenomena witnessed at Skull were genuinely paranormal, the popularisation of the case led to the emergence of new experimental home circles devoted to the development of physical mediumship, with circles often employing séance procedures influenced by the Skull setup. And it was at one of these private home circles that my main fieldwork informant Christine first became acquainted with mediumship, contemporary trance and physical mediumship. So the Bristol Spirit Lodge was established in 2005 as a centre for the development of trance and physical mediumship, when Christine, who describes herself as a housewife, became convinced of the reality of spirit mediumship following a physical mediumship séance at Jenny's Sanctuary, a well-known spiritualist circle in Banbury. She had been invited to the séance by a friend, and not knowing what physical mediumship was, decided to go along. During the séance, conducted in a plain room with about 30 sitters, Christine saw bright light floating and flashing around the séance room, heard numerous voices, whistles and loud bangs coming from all corners, witnessed a partly materialised something, and to cap it all off, heard a voice that she recognised as belonging to her deceased father. In a short self-published autobiography, Christine describes the profound effect of this séance experience on her worldview. She writes, "I now had no option but to believe that something very serious was happening. I felt sick with the sudden shock. I knew I couldn't ignore reality. There are no boundaries. We simply cannot see all that exists. I needed to somehow persuade my mind to accept this fact completely. Otherwise, I would close my mind, whilst at the same time knowing that my previous belief was incorrect. I had believed that when we died, we were dead. I needed to get a grip of us to learn from the experience that had been offered to me in the séance at Banbury." So prior to her life-changing séance experience, Christine claims that she was uninterested in religious and spiritual matters, jokingly describing herself as a devout atheist. She claims no psychic abilities, though she does have a spirit guide, and recalls only two possible paranormal experiences from her youth. She does recall an invisible friend she had during a period of family disruption, but interprets this as nothing more than a psychological crutch, seeing no reason to consider it a hint at her future interest in spirit mediumship. She was, however, particularly interested in the developments of modern science, having read Stephen Hawking's popular A Brief History of Time and journalist Lynn McTaggart's Pop Science, and some might say pseudoscientific, book on quantum physics and consciousness, The Field. Her autobiography describes how she attempted to interpret the experiences she had while in the seance through the lens of her interest in science, which she describes as a DIY housewifey awareness of science. She now has a great enthusiasm for mediumship, a fact alluded to by the sheer amount of time she spends in her lodge with developing mediums. By now, she has taken part in over 1,000 seances. So the lodge itself is a wooden shed in Christine's back garden. Originally, while still based in Bristol, the lodge was constructed using £2,000 of her savings, according to simple rules recommended by the circle leader at Jenny's Sanctuary. It was important to Christine that the lodge be built with love and it be imbued with positive emotions. To this end, all the materials used to construct it were blessed, kissed, and treated with great respect. It was important to Christine that the lodge only be associated with positive energies, so as to avoid the risk of attracting negative entities during seances. The lodge was aligned so that the seance cabinet, a curtained-off corner of the room in which the medium sits while in trance, and a direct descendant of the spirit cabinets used by physical mediums in the late 19th and early 20th centuries, was located in the north corner, a location deemed conducive to the flow of energies necessary for the development of physical mediumship. All mediums at the lodge are working towards the manifestation of various physical phenomena, including levitation, transfiguration, ectoplasmic materialization, dematerialization of the body, and also psychic surgery, and all of this under the direction of the discarnate spirit teams. However, the majority of seances held in the lodge are trance sessions, during which the medium enters into a trance state and allows members of their spirit team to communicate with the sitters. Individual members of each medium spirit team are usually differentiated through the use of distinctive bodily postures and exaggerated vocalizations.
You're on camera now. Would you like to tell everybody what you used to do?
Not again.
Yes, again. Sorry. I know it must get boring for you, but...
I was an undertaker a long time ago.
Folk models of mind and matter. I use the term folk psychology to refer to models of understanding the mind built upon personal experience, inference, and intuition. So I'm interested in how models of mind are formed from personal experience. The term ethnometaphysics was coined by the American ethnographer A. Irving Halliwell in his discussion of Native American Ojibwa ontology to refer to the nature of the world of being as conceived and experienced in different cultural systems. So I'm interested in the ethnometaphysics of the Bristol Spirit Lodge. My approach is also experience-centred, drawing on the writings of folklorist David Hufford, who writes that the primary theoretical statement of the experience-centred approach might be roughly summed up as follows. Some significant portion of traditional supernatural belief is associated with accurate observations interpreted rationally. This does not suggest that all such belief has this association, nor is this association taken as proof that the beliefs are true. So the idea here, in the context of the Bristol Spirit Lodge, is that their supernatural belief system, or ethnometaphysics, is founded upon rational interpretations of the experiences had during seances. That is not, as Hufford states, to say that the experiences are genuinely of a paranormal nature, though they could be, but just to suggest that the experience itself has validity and that such beliefs are not to be lightly brushed aside as necessarily irrational or unfounded. After all, as we have already seen, the lodge was established specifically so that Christine could apply her housewifey DIY knowledge of science to understand the experiences she had at the seance in Banbury. So this section of an interview with Christine demonstrates how belief at the lodge is not a fixed position, but rather represents an ongoing process of learning and interpretation. Indeed, in a recent interview, Christine explained how she has a problem with the word belief, explaining how she thinks she is just generally mistrusting, and that without evidence, she has difficulty believing in anything. She explains how her experiments with mediumship have expanded her way of thinking about the world.
It certainly expands the possibilities. I wasn't thinking any of this when I started 6 years ago. You learn all the time. I mean, I'm doing 3-4 seances a week and have, you know, over 1,000 seances with all different people, all different mediums, in all different situations. I am fascinated by it still. I'm not one least bit satisfied that I've learned anything.
Mm-hmm.
I want more. You know, I want more and more and more. Because it's bigger a subject than any other I've hit on.
Mm-hmm. So a few of the key ideas that, according to my interview data, have arisen from this experimental process of learning in the seance include the idea that consciousness can survive the death of the physical body, that personhood is partible, that the body is permeable, that reality is non-physical, that consciousness is a fundamental property of the universe, and that it plays a central role in the construction of reality. Interview extracts. In this extract from Sandy, a nutritional therapist in her late 40s and a medium at the Lodge, she describes how her experiences developing mediumship over the past 4 years have led her to a firmer understanding that personal consciousness survives the physical death of the body.
I'm much more relaxed. I've been able to think about what I believe in.
Mm-hmm.
It never occurred to me before. I just didn't think about it. And it's changed the pace of my life. It's changed my knowledge of continuation after we've died. And it's given me comfort in that way. The funny thing was, before it ever happened, I knew my brother and my grandmother still existed. But it never occurred to me that anybody else did either. But because I was the only two people that I'd known to die, then I knew they were still about. But that's as far as I'd ever thought it.
Yeah.
I'd never looked into any of it. I'd never.
Similarly, this quotation from Emily, a 33-year-old mother of two and office worker who has recently begun to develop physical mediumship at the Lodge, describes how her experiences with mediumship have led to a reassurance of her own belief in survival. She says, "I think it has proven that there is more to life, and I guess I'm not worried about death. I also feel like I'm contributing to getting the message and something evidential out there to help people believe in the reality of continuing life, as I believe this to be, and come closer to understanding what exists around them. I feel that it's amazing and it should be shared." And one of the most interesting ideas that has emerged, in my opinion, is that spiritual beings can be useful, that they can actually help in everyday life in a variety of ways, and I refer to this as an augmentation. And here Sandy explains how the spirits help her to keep a clear mind.
They help me. They help me keep a clearer mind, and therefore, I'm able to make better decisions. I can utilise information that I've got. As Chris said, I did a degree in nutritional medicine. Years ago, I was a nurse and a midwife, and there's a lot of information in my head somewhere. But I can actually tap in on information that I've not used in years and years and years and years, and that I wouldn't have thought I could have remembered so readily.
Mm-hmm.
And I've certainly done that.
Mm. So they help you,
yeah,
in terms of accessing stuff that you already have.
Yeah.
That's interesting.
But stuff that I wouldn't have actually put into practice for years and years, and kind of applying it,
mm-hmm,
and kind of, there's this bit of information, there's this bit of information, and, you know, kind of playing around with it.
Yeah. Along similar lines, Christine explains how she interacts with her spirit guide, Fuzzy Critter, also known as FC. Fuzzy Critter plays an important role in the organisation of the seances, and directs Christine on occasion in order to get the energies right. She writes, "As time went on in trusting Fuzzy Critter and these telepathic voices, I did get to a point where I knew it was separate from me. It was a separate personality. The words he uses are better than mine. His language is different to mine. His general way of thinking, it's not me. In fact, sometimes I'll argue with him. I have a sense he seems to approach me from this side of my shoulder, this side of my head. I, in my own mind, feel he's a bit like a fluffy owl sitting on my shoulder. Sometimes it's annoying if I'm doing housework and he wants to communicate with me, and I get this feeling, it's a bit like having something playing with your hair or whispering in your ear when you're trying to do something." So for me, these kinds of experiences hint at a model of personhood that is different to the usually assumed Western model, which Clifford Geertz defined as a bounded, unique, more or less integrated motivational and cognitive universe. A dynamic centre of awareness, emotion, judgment and action, organised into a distinctive whole and set contrastively against other such wholes and against its social and natural background. So it seems to me that experiences with mediumship would appear to lead towards a different perspective, one that has usually been classified as a non-Western model of personhood, which is contrasted with the Western model in that the person is conceived to be porous and susceptible to external influences. And we also see this idea emerge in descriptions of the body. Christine says,
I think we just flow through each other. We've got very blurred edges. We appear to be solid, but only our eyes are seeing this solid, the light reflection which causes us to appear solid. We're not.
Mm-hmm.
So our boundaries aren't where we think they are. We are here to experience whatever this is, this life form, this stage of life is. We are here to experience or to perceive things as solid, as an individual, and it's very part, a little tiny part of a very big life,
mm-hmm.
I think.
And in this extract, Emily describes the sensation of spirit beings moving into her personal space as she waits to go out into the lodge. She says, then, usually around the table while we are waiting for the start, I will feel a presence around me like a kind of enveloping feeling. The first thing I feel is as if a friend is standing unseen nearby. I have an awareness of there being someone there, near me, that is a friend. I then feel them come closer into my personal space in some quiet, gentle way. And in this audio extract from an interview with another medium, Rachel, who has been attending the lodge for just over 1 year, she explains how before developing mediumship, she would frequently experience unusual and often unpleasant sensations of spirits moving through her physical body. She explains,
In the middle of the night, I'd wake up and there was something. It's a sort of odd feeling. It's like if you can imagine taking off a polo neck jumper, but from inside yourself, it's like something's pulling, and it's kind of gone in, and then it's kind of pulling out, and I can't explain it. It's the weirdest feeling, but it's quite horrible. It's a quite horrible feeling, and it happens on about three occasions through my 30s, and in the end, I got talking to a medium. She said, sounds like it's like a spirit entity in you or somebody passing through you. And she said to contact the local spiritualist church. But I did that, but nobody there seemed to feel the same thing. It was all kind of, with mental mediumship, it all seems to be outside with the person coming in through the mind and talking. It wasn't, with me, it was a very physical thing. So I kind of think I was probably meant to be a physical medium even then.
There is also a belief that the physical body can, on occasion, dematerialise completely. This extract from a report by a sitter called Jerry, on witnessing a physical mediumship demonstration at the lodge, describes his difficulty in coming to terms with the apparent dematerialisation of the medium. He writes, I've been trying to think of words to adequately describe what I felt and saw, but it's impossible, really. I was sitting next to the cabinet, so when I was asked by Yellowfeather to move in front of the cabinet, I was able to do this quite easily, despite it being in blackout conditions at the time. When Yellowfeather asked me to feel the chair where the medium had been sitting, he wasn't there. His chair was empty. The spirit team had, they said, dematerialized him. I found this hard to believe, but the medium is a big lad and I was sitting right beside the cabinet and no one walked past me, so where was he? So all of this seems to me to suggest that the classical anthropological distinction between Western and non-Western personhood conceptions is simply, well, oversimplified, and that there are huge variations in the way that consciousness and the body are perceived even within a single dominant culture, and this calls for further investigation. And the final aspect of this ethno-metaphysical system that I want to touch upon is the notion of panpsychism, broadly defined as the idea that consciousness is inherent in all matter. Here is Christine explaining her understanding that even tables possess an element of consciousness.
It's funny because solid, I think that table has an element of consciousness, and I think it belongs to something. I think it's part of something. I think it's got a vibration. It's got a something. I don't know how or where it is, but people of certain psychics can pick up the memory of that table, the history of that table, the tree it belonged to. You know, you get sensitive enough, you can do all that stuff. I can't, but it has a being, a something. That table does. If that's got consciousness, it's beyond me. It really is beyond me about where it starts. Where does it come from? I don't know where it comes from. I haven't a clue.
Mm-hmm.
And it gets more and more complicated as you look into it and wonder about it. And now and again, a penny will drop and you think, and then it falls down the drain, really, because it hasn't got it. that's not it. I don't know what consciousness is. I've got no idea. I don't know where it comes from. I think it's everywhere, but everything is conscious.
Mm-hmm.
And to different degrees. And maybe the collective, maybe it collects together and becomes stronger. I don't know.
So just to conclude briefly, I think it's important to take experience seriously in the study of supernatural belief systems. Supernatural beliefs need not necessarily be classified as irrational or unscientific, and they might actually have something interesting to tell us about the world. In order to study these, I think it's useful to take what Fiona Bowie calls a cognitive empathetic approach, in order to appreciate that supernatural belief systems constitute a lived-in model of reality, just as valid as any other. Bowie writes of the need to re-evaluate the relationship between first, second and third order discourses and to propose a dialogue that is respectful and tentative rather than hegemonic and dismissive of the native point of view. And if we take this kind of open-ended approach, we might become privy to some interesting things, such as, for example, the idea that personhood concepts vary within a particular dominant culture. And this is interesting stuff.